Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Achtung, Achtung, it's James Holland here, and welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Now, in today's podcast, we've got a very special guest, because a few weeks ago, I travelled up to Penrith in the Lake District to visit Matt McKinnon Patterson, who is an amazing veteran of the Second World War. He fought in Italy, first with the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders, and then right at the end of the war with the SAS in Northern Italy. And he was absolutely fascinating, not just his wartime record, but also just growing up in Scotland as an orphan and what he got up to. This will probably be 3 episodes, I think. So this is the first, but I hope you enjoyed it. I thought it was utterly brilliant. Let's have a listen to what he's got to say. So, Matt, I thought just to start off with, I'd love to know about where you were born and brought up, if that's all right.
Yes. Well, I was born in Glasgow.
Yeah.
And I was born in a street called Rotten Row.
Rotten Row.
There was a hospital there.
Yeah.
And you can't get further down the social ladder than Rotten Row.
No.
And my mother died.
Oh, no. How old were you then?
Well, I was just born.
Oh, I see. When you were born.
When I was born. And I was placed into an orphanage. By the time I was a year and 11 months. And I was passed around from one part of the family to another, I think. But by the time I got to this orphanage, a year and 11 months, I couldn't walk, I couldn't talk, I couldn't feed myself.
So where was your father then?
Yeah, well, he had died at all. Or he'd done, I don't know where he'd gone. He was actually locked up as being sort of, he'd gone berserk. And I don't like to mention that. Anyway, I grew up in what you called Quarriers Orphan Homes of Scotland.
Wow.
And the couple that were there, she came from Lazenby and he came from Newcastle. They met in Newcastle Infirmary and got married, and then eventually they trickled up to there.
Right.
I think it was a job getting Christian couples at a time when unemployment was quite heavy, 1924,
yeah,
26. And they sort of looked after me until 13.
Right.
When an aunt wanted, I had a brother and 2 sisters, and my aunt wanted to take the brother out of the home when he was 15.
Yeah.
And the home said, no, we look after them, we place them. you see? And of course she blew her top, and eventually I got chucked out at 13 and a half. The superintendent, not the couple that brought me up, but the superintendent minister said, that's it, you can have them both. And so my brother and I were sent to live in Rutherglen, Glasgow.
But what was it like in the orphanage?
It was very nice.
Really?
Yes, I was... Yes, it was very, very nice. I'll tell you what it was like. I had one of the other lads that was in the orphanage with me. And one day, he came up this way. And we were busy talking to some people. And I sort of swanking about the fact I'd grown up in an orphanage. You know, pity me. And he turned to me and he said, you know, we were better off there than those kids in Glasgow. He said, we got 3 square meals a day.
Yeah.
We had a bed to ourselves.
Yeah.
We had 2 weeks' holiday down the coast at Dunoon, near Dunoon and in Ellen. Lord Rowallan gave the home a big mansion house, and we used to use it for 2 weeks during the summer holidays.
And I suppose you were with your pals, weren't you?
And you were with all your pals. There were 40-odd houses.
Right.
And the beautiful houses, architecturally built. And in each house, there'd be either 30 boys or 30 girls, or give or take.
Yeah.
Probably mostly give. There was about 600 boys and 500 girls in that home, right? And each house had a Christian couple looking after them.
Right.
Right, the boys. The girls had 2 Christian women. We were all ages, from me at 1 year and 11 months to lads of 16. And there was no uniform.
No.
We went to church regularly.
Did you?
Well, twice on Sunday.
Yep.
And once during the week on a Wednesday evening. Wednesday evening was more relaxed. It was usually slides from a visiting wish missionary coming home.
Right.
So really and truthfully, our education was better than the kids in Glasgow.
Right.
Because we knew all about places in Africa.
Yeah.
Argentina, heck knows where else, you know.
And did you have schooling as well?
Always schooling there. I'll tell you what, when I came to live in Glasgow, in Rutherglen, I had to go to school. Because I wasn't quite 14.
Yeah,
right. I had 6 months of school. And I tell you quite seriously, we were further advanced in the orphanage than they were at Rutherglen.
Isn't that interesting?
But mind you, can I tell you a story?
Yeah, please do.
The teacher at Rutherglen, he was teaching us mathematics.
Yeah.
And he was, I was new boy. Everywhere we went, new boy, new boy, right, new boy. Right. Anyway, he gets up on the blackboard, Pythagoras' theorem. And he does it all, proves Pythagoras' theorem, right?
Yeah.
That blackboard, over to another one on an easel, back to wipe half of this one off and carry on. And he looks at it and everybody's sitting back thinking, oh, crummy. And he threw his chalk up in the air and he caught it round the back like that. He was very clever that way. And he says, new boy, show us what you can do. He didn't know a thing about me. He thought he'd got to say, everybody's having a good old laugh at new boy.
Yeah.
Idiot coming out. Because when you're a new boy in a school, the idiot moves up one. You move it.
Yeah.
And I went there and I just wiped the board clean. We'd done it 6 months before. And from then on, new boy was top boy, you see. Eventually I left there. And I went to work in a big warehouse in Glasgow called Campbell Stuart and MacDonald.
Thomas Stuart MacDonald.
Campbell Stuart MacDonald.
Campbell Stuart MacDonald.
Oh, yes, all 3 of them. I think Campbell's there to keep the MacDonalds and Stuarts apart. And I worked there for some time, and then I got fed up with that.
So hold on a minute. What year were you born? When were you born then?
1924. That's going back a little bit, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a little bit, yeah. So you would have got to, if you were 13 and a half, that means you would have been 1937?
36, 37.
37, you were back in Glasgow.
In the 36, I was, I remember, I was still in the home when King Edward VIII abdicated.
Right.
And then
that's the beginning of 1937, isn't it?
The 36 was, I came out, and then 37, I was in Rutherglen. I had 6 months to go at school.
Yep. So then you finished school in, what, 1938, something like that?
Yes, about 1938. I came out and I didn't like this job where I was. I wasn't very happy.
Well, what was it? What was the work?
Errand boy.
Right.
I wasn't very happy. I missed the home.
Yeah.
And I was actually in the home since I'd come in as a baby. I was well looked after by the couple, more or less. I was their son.
Right.
If you like to put, I mean, when does a woman put a child down and say, right, no longer, you get with the rest? Hmm. She never did, never could. I used to come down here on holiday with them. Oh. When it was their time for a break.
Yeah.
I used to come down to Lazenby 1 week in February and 2 weeks in June.
Amazing.
And before I was 5 years old. And I got to know Lazenby very well. In fact, when I went preaching up here years later, and I'm at Appleby, and I went preaching and I got appointed to Lazenby one day, and I walked into the pulpit and I said, does anybody here remember so-and-so and so-and-so? And I rattled off a lot of names, and they're all sitting looking at me, wondering who the dickens I am. And I did the same at Risendale. I went in there and I sort of gave them a little, and TB as well.
Yeah.
Because I knew people that had been there when I was a kid.
Right.
Anyway,
so you didn't stay long at Campbell Stuart MacDonald?
No, I think I was out of there quick. And my aunt contacted somebody called Dr. Cosser. And Dr. Cosser, before I was 15,
yep.
Dr. Cosser came to see me, or the solicitor, family solicitor, called in Dr. Cosser. Dr. Cosser used to go round the courts, and he used to pick up boys that were, you know, like been picked up and put in the court for minor demeanours. And he'd pick them up, and if he felt they could help them, he'd take them and train them how to become a farmer. Now, he'd bought two farms. He would teach us farming, milking cows and all that.
Yeah.
So I went through a course, 9 months of that.
Well, that must have been quite fun, wasn't it?
Not really. That was all right. It wasn't quite the... I remember war was declared while I was there.
Right.
And we're sitting in a group. There was about 20 lads. I was sitting there listening to the radio. Eventually, I left there.
Sorry, when you were listening to the broadcast that war had been declared, I mean...
Yeah.
Can you remember what everyone thought about it? I mean, were you...
What everybody thought about it?
Mm.
Two groups. One group said, cool, great. Obviously.
Yeah.
Just, you know, others lot saying, oh, yeah, here we go again.
Yeah.
And but everybody just accepted it.
Right.
Then, of course, out come the propagandists.
Yep.
Do not talk about this. Don't be a defeatist.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the end, everybody's in.
Yes.
And so you had to be careful what you said in those days, just as bad as it is today. Anyway, I went through the farming. War had been declared, did my 9 months at Kilwinning.
Yep.
Put on a farm in Kilmarnock, overlooking the Clyde, Ailsa Craig, Arran, beautiful view.
Wow.
But I didn't want to be a farm boy. Unfortunately, the government intervened by saying all agricultural workers are exempt from military training. So I packed my little suitcase and off I shot.
Because you didn't want to be exempt?
I wanted to get into the army.
Did you? Why was that?
My nature.
Yep.
My pride.
Yep.
Biggest factor in life is pride.
Yeah.
And.
But what was it about it? You just wanted to be a part of it, or you felt you would be a good soldier?
You didn't want to miss a fight. Crummy, you grew up with this First World War in your background, and everybody talking about it in one way or another. And you sort of felt, you know, I'm not going to be left out.
Right. You felt that quite strongly, did you?
Oh, yeah, we all felt that strongly, except those that didn't want to feel that strongly. It's one of those things that you feel you have to do. It's an occasion you don't want to miss. It's an experience you'd think you need to know. Because you grew up with casual blokes from the First World War.
Yeah.
Coming along and telling you half a story.
Yes.
And oh, you kids don't know what it's like to be in blah, 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 blah. You say, well, tell us. Oh, no, I'm not, I don't want to talk about it. Usually find out they were base swallows. They never did anything.
Yes.
And, but you grew up with this. I stayed there. I came away from there that day and I went to work in Glasgow.
Right. So you left the farm.
Eh?
This was after leaving the farm.
After leaving, doing the midnight flit.
Yeah. And, oh, you basically went out in the middle of the night, did you?
Oh, early in the morning.
You just left?
I just got up and packed my cases and left.
What, you didn't tell anyone?
No, I didn't tell anybody, but I was well liked there. I got well.
Yeah.
I enjoyed my time on the farm.
But it just wasn't what you wanted to do?
It wasn't what I wanted to be stuck with during the war.
No.
While every other lad's coming back saying that they were at this and that and that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you were busy milking cows.
Yeah, I understand that.
Anyway, I worked in Glasgow. I went into lodgings and I looked after myself. And only
did you, I mean, presumably by that stage, so what are we now, 1940, 41, something like that?
Well, in 1940, yes, I think it was around about 1930, 39 war was declared.
Yes.
40 I was in the farming, and somewhere around about 41, I was in the shipyard.
So anyway, so you'd have been 17?
I'd be 17. I was in the shipyards. And I remember that Russia was dragged into the war.
Yes, that's June 1941.
I remember that for a simple reason. In the shipyards, I became great pals of the Communist Party. And so when Russia, and they used to sort of try and, you know, they weren't going to help the war effort, you know.
Right.
And then when Russia came in, they were going around telling, hey, come on, move, get a move on, you know.
And what was it about the Communist Party that appealed to you?
I don't know. I suppose when you think about it, it's what's the difference between... I was brought up in a very strong Christian religion.
Yeah.
We weren't... In the orphanage, we weren't force-fed religion.
No.
We were slight dispensed spoonfuls of preventative medicine. If the good Lord didn't on the grounds, if the good Lord didn't want you, old Satan was going to have a devil of a job getting you.
Right.
So you grew up with a tremendously moral principles.
But you must have, but by the age of 17, you must have been incredibly resilient and good at looking after yourself and.
Well, yes, I
knew your own mind and all that sort of thing.
Well, I had about 30 bob wages, 10 bob went from the room. And I lived on cornflakes at one time. And then eventually, the only people in the shipyard, when they found out I was on my own, the communists, one or two of the communist fellows, took me back to their house to feed me.
Right.
Nobody else did.
Right.
And that's where I started thinking, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was very pro-communist. In fact, they could see in me a star. But then I felt, well, I can't live on this money at the shipyard.
Right.
So I got another job doing night shift in a factory.
Wow.
And I did night shift and then I got proper lodgings.
Right.
30 bob a week.
Goodness.
And, you know, you had your bed, but you knew that when you were on night shift, somebody else was in that bed during the, at other times, like, you know, while you were at night shift. So the old landlady was playing the old fiddle, but it didn't matter. They were up to all the tricks in those days. Eventually, when I got to 18, I went along to the Army recruiting office in Glasgow.
Yep.
And I signed on. Well, I walked in and I said, I want to join the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders.
And why did you want to join them?
Because my uncle had been in that, and he got killed at the Battle of Loos.
Ah, yes.
Queen's brother got killed. Queen Elizabeth I, the mother, Queen Mother's brother got killed. I walked in and said, I want to join the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders. They said, sorry, full up. I said, all right then, full up. I said, And he said, you needn't bother about the Camerons, Gordons and Seaforths. He said, they're full up and all. Well, I didn't want a Lowland Regiment. I wanted a Highland Regiment.
Okay, you just and that was because of your uncle and because...
That's right.
You'd worked in the farm in the Highlands and all sorts of stuff. You just had a connection to the Highlands.
No. We just... The name McKinnon came from the Highlands.
Ah.
I wanted to join the Highland Regiment.
Okay.
Because of his uncle, I think. And I said, oh, why is that then? He said, we've got train loads of them coming up from Lancashire and Yorkshire. He said, every blooming one of them claims to be Scottish descent, and they're coming up in the train loads. And when I got into the Argyles, I found most of the Scots regiment were about 60% Lancashire, Yorkshire. We used to march to Lassie from Lancashire more than we ever marched to one of the Scottish tunes.
Right.
Ilkemoor Bartat, I knew that off before I remembered Scots were here and all that stuff.
And so this is 1942.
42 when yeah. I joined up.
Yeah.
I joined up in August 42. October 42, I'm in Perth.
Right. And what was your... When's your birthday?
August. I was right signed on my birthday.
Right.
August the 14th.
That's the same as my daughter's.
Ah, that's good. You remember it now then.
Yeah.
And then they called me up to Perth on the 1st of October. And I walked in the gates of Perth, gave my name, signed in. The chap behind me come in, very la-di-da, blah, blah, blah. I could just hear him giving his name and things.
Yeah.
We went and we picked our kit up.
Mm-hmm.
We come walking back and the two of us were told, you know, your bunk is up there.
So are you now in the Argyll and Sutherland Highlands?
I'm now, I just joined up.
You just joined up as a recruit with no regiment.
I'm still wearing my civvy clothes, but I'm carrying my army ones.
Got you.
And I'm lugging them along there, and there's another bloke with me, and the two of us get there, and we get to the dormitory, and he says, oh, which one shall we have? I said, well, I'm going to have that one. I'll have that one next year. He went, and we said, actually, time went on.
Mm.
You know, we got quite friendly.
Mm.
I says, what? He said to me, oh, what school did you go to? Well, said, I went to the most expensive school in Scotland. I said, people were dying to send the kids to my school. Oh, which one was that? Loretto? I said, no, Quarriers. I've never heard of it. And which one did you go to? Eton. Eton's in one bed, next bed to... And I'm in Quarriers Orphanage is in the next bed.
Yeah.
And the third bed over there, who came in later and heard his accent, Robertson's Jam Factory. he came from over Bristol, what do you call it? And then he and I got along like us. I was off with quite old pals.
So why was he there? He'd just been recruited?
He just joined up. Huh? Once upon a time, these two would have walked straight into a commission.
Yeah.
But now, the law said a commission must be taken... Recruits must be taken from the ranks.
Yeah.
And so they've got to go through the primary training
first
before they can come up, you see?
Right.
And these two went on to Officers Cadet Training Unit in no time, like, you know.
Yeah.
They passed right through. Before they passed through, they put my name down for a commission. I was called in to my interview. Bloke looked up at me and said, how do you intend to pay your mess bills? And I said, well, my wages. You need a lot more than that. He says, wow, you know. And you suddenly realise, yes. It took me a long while to figure what that meant. And I've only just discovered what that question really meant. It didn't mean how much money have I got. Would I be paying by cheque or by direct debit or whatever it was?
Yes.
Had I enough to do that?
Yeah.
And it was money. And I just walked out. I thought, I'll stuff you. I walked out. I was a Lance Corporal at the time. I'd been promoted to Lance Corporal as a Lance Corporal instructor. Mm. Within 6 months of being in the Army,
yeah.
I'm an Army instructor.
And did you find that Army life suited you then?
Yeah, I got along all right in it. As I say, I became a Lance Corporal within a few months of being in the Army.
Yes.
And then I was made up to Lance Corporal Instructor. And I wasn't even in the army a whole year. I was about five or six months. And I got posted up to Lanark here to instruct new recruits.
Right.
I've got a landscape on there. But in the meantime, when I'm still on the move, we moved from Perth.
Yes.
Down to Suffolk in what became the Highland Regiment. In other words, all boys under 19 in the five Highland Regiments were now grouped into one regiment called the Highland Regiment.
Right.
And that was a training regiment.
Got you.
And the cap badge is quite worth a bob or two. And I've still got one. Huh. And we moved from Perth to Suffolk, mm-hmm. to near Mildenhall, mm-hmm. Fakenham.
Yeah.
Then we moved from there down to Leigh-on-Sea, Essex. Mm-hmm. Do you know it?
I do, yeah.
Well, down at Leigh-on-Sea, on the Sunday after Sunday, we were free to wander about downtown. And I met my first wife then. She was 15 and I was 18.
Right.
5 years later, we got married.
How wonderful.
But then, after I'd gone to Lanark in the meantime, and then when I became, you couldn't go abroad until you were 19.
Right.
So whenever somebody said that they were landing on here and they were doing this when they were 18, I think, aye, aye, either you've told lies about your age or you're telling lies.
Right.
And we got married, and then I went in and I said, when I come 19, I went into the office again and I said, I want to go abroad, overseas. And of course, I got posted to Italy.
Right.
Well, first.
So 1943, you'd have been 19, right?
You couldn't
August
go.
August 1943.
You couldn't get in. You were not supposed to go abroad till you were 19.
Yeah.
And I think because at Dunkirk or something, they got quite a number of younger lads got killed, and so they insisted 19 minimum age. And I was down to Liverpool on the ship.
Yes.
And then I went to, on the ship, we went to Algiers.
Yes.
Algiers, we went to cross the Bizerta.
Yeah, in Tunisia.
And on our way to Italy.
On the Monarch.
On the Monarch of Bermuda.
Wow.
And we got to Italy just before the first Battle of Cassino was about to start.
Right, so this had been very early 1944.
And we were stuck in a transit camp, not too far up.
Yeah.
Ready, but we were not. We were ready to be. We were all mixed.
Where was that?
All mixed regiments.
Was that somewhere like Caserta or somewhere like that?
Yeah, might have been Caserta.
Yeah.
Where the army headquarters were.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, we weren't far from there, and I can't remember the name now because it's a long time. But we were there in the first battle as a total reserve, like, you know, anywhere, any problem. Transit camp.
You're just a replacement troops. You haven't been allocated a regiment at this point.
Reinforcement holding unit.
Reinforcement holding unit, yeah.
Yeah. And we.
But you haven't got a regiment at this point.
Oh, no. Well, I haven't joined my battalion.
No.
But we're all different nationalities, all different regiments.
Yep.
And a bit of a comedy turn here. While we were there, it was all these different regiments, about 30 men in each group.
Yep.
And the sergeants, they didn't know what to do with us. And one day, one of them said, right, everybody out, PT kit on, cross-country run, five miles. And off we set. Well, I just plodded along. And I come in first out of about 200 or 300. Before we set off, the sergeants are all saying to each their own regiment, right, don't forget, you're running for the Argyles. Mm. And then...
And you're still a lance corporal at this stage.
Yeah, they made me keep that up, strangely enough.
Yep.
Because of the job getting people to take it.
Mm.
Not a lance corporal, nobody wanted that because you were unpaid. You got all the responsibility and none of the money.
Right.
And... We'd go all this way around, and it started to be every day.
Right.
We were going on this cross-country run, and every day I'd win.
Right.
And every day before we set off, a sergeant would come to me and he'd say, run for the regiment. Yeah, okay, son. I'd run. I didn't realise till a long while later, somebody told me he was running a book on me. And I was a blooming favourite. No wonder, they all hated me because of you, we're getting dragged out every day. You know. Well, anyway, eventually, second battle, we moved up a bit closer.
So this is now February 44?
We're coming into the second battle. We're a bit closer. Third battle, we're right up there.
This is the one in the town. Yeah,
and we're just a little bit back, but we get shelled.
Yeah.
And we get shot at and everything else.
I mean, this is your first taste of combat.
First taste of combat, right.
And what did you make of it? What were your impressions of the Gustav line?
Just a minute, tell you something. Fourth battle, we're front line.
Yes, of course.
We're the attack.
This is Operation Diadem.
We're on the attack.
Yeah.
And we've got to cross the Rapido River.
Yeah.
In boats.
Yes.
I am in the battalion of the 1st Battalion of the Argyles.
So you got to where you wanted?
I got where I wanted. And
did you ever have any choice in that? I mean, did you?
Well, you just drift. You just drift with it. You've got to be very careful that they don't put you with somebody else. You know, you're 1st Argyles, but you could come along and say, they need more recruits up in that one there. That's why we were on 4-3-2 battle. We were back,
sure, but
ready to go anywhere.
But the Argyles was the place you wanted to go in the first
place.
That
was my regiment.
So was it luck when you eventually got attached to your battalion, the 1st Battalion?
No, I just went along with the drift.
Right,
It wasn't as much luck. It was dodging the fact that they might say, oh, we need 10 blocks of the Black Watch, you know, sunk. Or right. 10 blocks of the Sussex Regiment there.
Yeah.
Your theory, you had no regiment.
Right.
You could go be stuck anywhere. And if in one of the one, two or three battles some regiment suffered heavy losses,
then off you'd go.
Then they would just come back to the reinforcement holding unit and, you know, you 20 in there.
Right. But once you've given your battalion, you stay with the battalion, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was still a lance corporal. They keep telling me every time I go, I'm supposed to lose my tape.
Right.
Because whenever you move in the army as a lance corporal, you lose your tape. As a corporal, you keep it, if you've been corporal for more than so many months. But everywhere I went, I said, keep it, keep it, keep it. And eventually, I'm assigned to the 1st Battalion, Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders, 8th Indian Division.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Indian Division was a brigade is three regiments,
yes,
three battalions. Two Indian and one British.
Yeah.
Right, we were in one of them.
The British bit, yeah.
Right. When I get there, they come along and they say, oh, keep your tape up. But I mean, these blokes have been in battle before. It don't matter. I've got eight men under me.
Yep.
I'm a lance corporal.
And can you remember which company it was?
C Company.
C Company, 1st Battalion.
1st Battalion. And I'm...
Right.
And I got a Lieutenant Gammy in charge of my platoon.
Gammy.
He was a blooming idiot.
Was he?
Oh, gosh, yes.
In what way?
Bumble.
Right.
Public school boy, bumble.
Didn't really know what he was
doing. I
think
he was going to become a solicitor, I said. I don't know. He never got relaxed with you. And anyway, I had to take these men, a section, into battle. They were all older than me, taller than me, they were all more experienced than me. Billy Muggins has got the blooming lance tape and I've got to lead them. And
I
should have been a full corporal.
Yeah, but well, you should have been. If you were given a section, you should have been a full corporal.
I should have been full corporal.
Yeah.
Lance corporal usually did the Bren Gun group.
That's right.
Anyway, I've got a full section. And we get ready for the fourth battle. We do a bit of practice on these little rowing boat things we've got, you know.
Yeah.
Collapsibles.
They're little sort of canvas things, aren't they?
Canvas things, right. And we line up on the night of the battle. And the guns are going like the clappers behind us.
Yeah.
And Jerry's shelling us as well. And you're standing there
They're all behind Monte Trocchio, aren't they? They're all behind Monte Trocchio. That's where they were, all the guns were at Casino. Anyway, for the Diadem battle.
I didn't even know where that was.
Don't forget. Well, it's the mouth of the Liri Valley.
Yeah.
So you've got Monte Cassino on the right. Then a little way back, you've got this low saddled hill, which is sort of at 90 degrees to the Liri Valley.
Yeah.
And all the guns, that was Monte Trocchio, and all the guns are behind that.
Oh, were they?
And then you've got the Rapido coming down from the other side of Casino, and then and the interesting thing about the Liri Valley is it's much sort of more undulating than it looks like from the top. It's quite hilly, isn't it, in a way?
You mentioned the Rapido. What was it like when you saw it?
Well, I guess it would be about 15, 20 yards across, something like that.
More than that, yeah.
And it's quite a plunging, you've got to go down there's a sort of quite high banks either side of it. Right. Not easy to get in and out of, I wouldn't have thought.
No. When I last saw it, it was a trickle.
It wasn't.
When we went out there.
Wasn't in 1944, was it?
I could have walked across it.
Yeah.
1944, it was up, right up to the brim.
Yeah.
I don't know how Jerry managed that. He diverted something.
Yes, they flooded the upper Rapido Valley.
Yeah.
But also, the winter had been unbelievably wet.
Yes.
It just rained and rained and rained and rained and rained. So you had lots of water coming out of the mountains and flowing into these rivers, which then obviously flew to the sea.
I've often wondered. And anyway, we're standing there in this long line, and there's a hell of a din going on. You're deafened. Then suddenly a whistle blows and our guns stop. Another whistle, you hear somebody else over there, and the Jerry guns stop.
Right.
And even a conversation between a Bren gun and a Spando stops.
Right. It's just silence.
Eh? Quiet.
Yeah.
It's so quiet you could hear the silence.
Yeah.
And you're standing there, absolute silence. A firefly went past, and I looked at him and I thought, myself, you lucky devil. You don't know what's going on. Firefly, it was so quiet.
Yeah.
Further down, some of the chaps said they could hear the frogs croaking in the marshes.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, a whistle goes, and all hell lets loose. And that's our signal. Right, lads, let's go. Now, down to both sides of the Rapido, you may have seen it, marshland.
Yes.
In great deep ditches for draining. There's one or two what I used to call dehydrated riverbeds going down. They were dry.
Yeah.
And we had placed our pontoon there. I get my squad then, and we go down and we pick one up, right? And we carry it down to the river. There's hell let loose. Shell, all the side of you. You can hear this shrapnel ricocheting everywhere and everyone else. You can hear the bullets flying, whizzing past,
Yeah.
And it's just all hell let loose. No.
And can you remember at all how you were feeling? I mean, are you...
Yes, I've got to tell you. Going to tell you, one of my crown statements. I was blessed at that time with what you might call boyhood bravado.
Right.
Where you're thinking, not going to stop me. Right. This is what I've been waiting for. This is I'm a man now.
So you weren't scared?
Not the slightest. We just went in, and I was in charge of these 8-10 men. And they're picking up the little pontoon craft and carrying it down to the river. And they put it in the river, and I get in, and we row across. And I get up. And it's a high bank, but by then the river's well up on it. So it wasn't too steep. But for me, pretty steep. For you, probably a stride. And we got up there, and the next thing I know is I'm getting my section sorted out. Now, our job was to go from the company was to move that way and then in and occupy the trench and these ditches.
Yeah.
We were to pick up these ditches and turn them into trenches.
Sure.
As we get up, my company goes that way, I'm ready to go that way. Suddenly, an officer steps in front of me and says, wait, hold on, D Company's got to come through first. But I say, wait, I'm with C Company. He said, stay where you are. You do as you're told. D Company passes by. My C Company's gone away down there. And I'm left with 10 men. And I say, right, lads, we're ready. When D Company's gone through, an old soldier says to me, he says, Corporal, he said, let's sit down, he said. You won't get anywhere if you start running around. So we sat down. We waited. We got shelled.
Yeah.
One or two bloke got hit with bullets.
So how long does it take for a company to pass through? A little while.
It's about 500, what's a company?
Company's about 120 men, but then you've got 10%
100
left.
100 men.
100 men, yeah.
Yeah, it didn't take too long, but it was long enough.
To get separated.
And it's lost my contact.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know where we was, our company was supposed to turn. Anyway, they went past, and eventually we waited till the morning. There was a great smoke screen everywhere, so not only you can't see, but you're stuck in a mist.
Yeah, fog of war.
This old soldier told me, he said, stay here, cop. He said, you're wasting your time looking. Till in the morning, when there's a bit of light, we'll start and find them out. So in the morning, I get up and I leave one of the blokes in charge of the section, keep an eye on them, and I go and find out where we're to turn. Eventually, we get them and we get them back in. We get into our proper place.
Right.
Which was our proper place for the D Company was supposed to be on our left. How the hell they ended up on our right, I don't know.
Well, all that smoke, I suppose.
But eventually, I found our company. And I managed to get up to them, get the lads in. And I'm waiting and watching just about as far as up that wall is a great long barbed wire fence. It's absolutely loaded with barbed wire. And we take a look at it. And I said to them, I said, I just think we've got to get through that, are we? No, said the old soldier said, no, let the artillery do it. He said, they'll belt it to pieces. Well, the artillery had two or three goes at it. And we got more shrapnel from them than anybody else. And still we sat there. We sat there for a day. And then next day, we're all nicely settled in. We were not moving. And I'm getting no instructions to move.
No.
And if you went forward with a pair of pliers and tried to cut that wire, old Jerry's sniping you.
Right.
So the best thing to do is sit still and wait. Now, before that, the Canadian Tank Corps had told us, we won't be able to help you because it's marshland. But later on, they said, we'll help you if you ever get stuck. But anyway, while we're there during the day, the Sergeant Major comes running along the trench, past all my chaps, stands beside me, looks about. He turns to me, he said, follow me. So I followed him. And half a dozen
blokes. Just you?
No, there's half a dozen other blokes.
Right.
Come dashing along. Not my squad. He gets me down to the blimmin' boat, into the ship, into the pontoon, and he said, now, is everybody here injured? I said, I'm not. So he said, well, what are you doing here? I said, you told me to follow you. He said, oh, God, go on, off you go. So I went back, but I couldn't find them again. I had to go all the way around here. I managed to get up so far for D Company because the chap was signals bloke was going to fix the telephone. And I went back with him to D Company.
Right.
And then he was going to go to C Company later. So he was going to take me back because you couldn't find your way around.
Right.
And I'm with D Company, it's a little group of them. Suddenly Jerry starts shelling us.
Right.
One bloke says to me, he says, come on, we've got to scatter us. You can't all stay in here. So I said, well, where can I go? He says, the trench just front 20 or 30 yards ahead. Oh, right. So I get up and I run and I nearly fall in this trench and I fall asleep. And the shelling goes on and it's hell on earth. And you're just sitting there and I'm waking up and it's daylight and it's silence. And I crawl out of my trench. I go try to find my company. I start walking back. Oh, said everything. Oh, the girls have been withdrawn. Why? Well, I said, the gooms broke through. You know the gooms, North Africa?
Yeah, yeah, yes, yes, yeah.
The gooms broke through. She said, yeah. Oh. And Jerry's retreated. So I come back. Eventually I get back to my unit. And I'm about the only NCO left. I've fallen. And you know what? I went back next day. I went back to look for stragglers, anybody that needed.
Yeah.
That slit trench had a Jerry blooming machine gun post right above me. And I slept while he fired.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that first part of my interview with Matt McKinnon-Patterson. Do look out for more. There'll be a couple more in the next few weeks. But in the meantime, cheerio for now.